Hello, and welcome to an appendix, if you will, to our session on of medicine. I spent so much time on the introduction and some of the sort of groundwork issues defining what alternative medicine is and having our initial discussions about it and its appropriateness and why it's alternative medicine that we were not able to get to our last two vignettes. So what I would like to do is very quickly summarize what we said regarding the first two issues and then explore the third and fourth. This should not be very long, because once you've done the first, everything else follows relatively logically. So our first question had been about recommending herbal medicine to a patient. The vignette was, Reuven, a home healthcare nurse, sees a medical herbalist routinely for his chronic fatigue syndrome and believes the treatment is effective. One of Reuven's regular patients complains of fatigue, for which he's being treated conventionally. Under professional regulations as well as halakha, may Reuven suggest to his patient that he see a medical herbalist while maintaining conventional medical care? So what we said was that there are certain concerns involved in alternative medicine, even when one would use it alongside conventional medicine. We noted certain ethical concerns. One question was, when we say that the Torah licenses the physician to heal, Verapo Yerapei permits the physician to heal, what exactly is included within that permission? We noted the view of Ibn Ezra and Rabbeinu Bechaye that Verapo Yerapei, this license to heal, applies only where there's a reasonable expectation that the medical professional knows what he or she is doing. We noted that we could look at that permission as exemption from liability for making a mistake. That was the view that we saw from the Shach commenting on the Code of Jewish Law. That was the view of Rav Kook, saying that all medicine is doubtful, and the point of the Torah's permission is to be expansive and say, don't worry about harming someone, but just how far does that go? So that was a consideration. We also noted the consideration that certain treatments may have their roots in what Judaism would consider pagan practices, and that may be a concern, which we said really requires its own discussion. That's a big topic in and of itself. And then third, the general question of promoting beliefs that are inconsistent with Judaism as one gets into some of these alternative ideas. And we noted Rabbi Dr. Tendler making that somewhat ambiguous and vague allegation. But the two real concerns as a matter of Jewish law are, number one, is there any risk of harm from this herbal medicine that we're talking about here? And we noted that's a very substantive possibility, that there could be harm, that there could be ways in which it actually counteracts conventional treatments that the patient is undergoing. We noted that it's very, very important that if one is going to give this advice to a patient, that you make sure that the patient is going to notify their conventional practitioners and notify the alternative medicine practitioner of what the conventional practitioners are doing, because there could be these conflicts. And what we said was that Judaism does, if you're going to look out for those types of harm, Judaism does allow people to take risks at a level commensurate with the expected benefit. So one would be allowed to take what is considered a normal risk. Then we had second concern. The second concern is a very big one, and it leads us really to the heart of the whole discussion of alternative medicine. We asked the question of, what if there is non-kosher food in this medicine, in this product that you're planning on taking? We suggested that the alcohol could come from a non-kosher source, that there could be animal extracts in it. Would one be allowed to take this product? And we said there's a degree of tension here, because medicine which is accepted is able to override those concerns for the sake of a medical need, both in terms of a life and death case, and even in what we call chole she'ein bo sakana, a patient who is not dangerously ill. However, we quoted from the Talmud that where the cure is not considered to be a real conventional medical cure, then it doesn't justify violating prohibitions. So we talked about that in terms of traveling in a public area on Shabbat while carrying a fox tooth, carrying an amulet. We talked about eating a dog liver to treat a dog bite. And what we said was that if the cure is not considered to be conventionally accepted, then you're not allowed to override prohibitions in order to pursue that cure. So that leads to the question, who defines what is a bona fide cure? Who defines what is conventional medicine? And after contrasting, or not contrasting, but presenting the CPSO's approach as well as the legal approach, we pointed to the Rambam, to Maimonides, who says a lot of different things in a lot of different places. We brought 2 points from his commentary to the Mishnah. We brought one from the Guide of the Perplexed, another one from his Mishnah Torah, which is his true work of law. And what we ended up with was that the Rambam, Maimonides, wants to see evidence that this works. It has to have been tested. And we showed that that is actually something that is picked up and used by other rabbinic authorities down till today. Well, the question is then, what does it mean that something is seen to have worked? What kind of testing do you require? And we noted the Talmud in Shabbat discussing amulets says if it works 3 times in a row, that demonstrates that it is considered effective. And we gave all the ins and outs, the amulet that worked for 3 patients, the amulet that worked 3 times for 1 patient, and so on. And based on that, the argument could be made that you don't need all of our highfalutin placebo controls and double blinds and all of that. Just see, anecdotally, did it work 3 times in a row? Shkoyach, that means that it works. However, we noted that testing standards can change over time as new means become available and new standards are set. We talked about that in terms of evidence being accepted to allow a woman to remarry on the supposition that her husband is dead. We talked about identifying a body that shows up as being that of her husband, where the Talmud talks about accepting it based on a mole, where you could identify the body based on a mole, and the commentators noted that, you know, that's not ironclad. It could be that, you know, 2 people in 1,000 have it, and yet you're willing to accept that. Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg pointed out that you could have, a recognition, what's called in the Gemara, tvias ayin, just that you look at the person's face and say, oh yeah, that looks like this fellow. You know, you didn't look at all the people in the world to determine that there's no one else who looks like that. Nowadays, people talk about using DNA evidence, where you're talking about 1 in trillions. And so Rabbi Zalman Nechemia Goldberg makes the point that the standards of DNA evidence are much more demanding than the standards of what the Talmud was willing to accept. And it's possible to argue that our standard may well change over time as the science changes. And indeed, halachic authorities seem to say that. Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Rabbi Asher Weiss, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg basically say we work with today's standard, and we work with today's authorities, we trust today's authorities, so that, going back to the question of recommending the herbal medicine, in the event that the herbal medicine might involve something that contradicts Jewish law, then we would say, well, if it doesn't meet the standard, if it isn't considered standard of care conventionally because it has not been tested, has not been testified to by experts who we rely upon, then no, it would not be an acceptable treatment. Okay. But if you're not violating prohibitions and you're watching for danger, you're watching for harm, then you could do this as a complementary medicine in addition to conventional medicine. That brought us to vignette number 2, where we talked about the case of the placebo and offering alternative medicine as a placebo, such as for stress, for the patient's stress. And we said that from a general ethical perspective, and certainly from the perspective of modern society and concepts like patient autonomy and informed consent and the public trust, it would be hard to sustain offering an alternative medicine to a patient as a placebo, you know, relying on it as the placebo. From a Jewish law perspective, I think there's more to be said, because number one, we've always recognized the value of placebo. I showed you an example of it in Maimonides. And we have a general paternalist tendency in Judaism when it comes to health. You are helping the patient get what the patient wants. The patient wants to eliminate stress. You're telling the patient, take this and you won't feel stress. And that's true. It's just that the patient thinks it's because of some special property of the item. And it's not. It's just because of what's going on in the patient's mind. So the argument could be made that that would be considered legitimate in a religion which talks about coercing people to accept treatment in cases of dire need. I still worry. I worry very much about the public trust component undermining trust in medical care. But I think it's an interesting question to explore. Okay, our last two vignettes. So, vignette, it was number three on our list. Chana, a family physician with 12 years of experience in practice, reads a physician's account of his own COVID recovery, which he credits to God, as well as to, quote, high-dose melatonin, vitamin C and D, zinc, coenzyme Q10, Aspalet, and one dose of ibuprofen for the fever. And that's a direct quote. If you look on the source sheet, you will see the link where you can find that story. From the perspective of halacha, what sort of evidence would Chana need to see in order to justify recommending this regimen for patients instead of conventional care? And notice, instead of conventional care. What would Chana need to see in order to say, I'm willing to go for this and not for conventional medicine? So we have a basic halachic and ethical duty to take care of our health. It's not for the individual, as far as Judaism is concerned, to say, well, I want to do something different. And that's direct in the Torah. We are told, v'nishmartem ma'od l'nafsho seichem, you shall guard your life. And there are many, many sources that we've discussed on other occasions, such that we have within Jewish law rulings which state that we are required to act to save our lives, even if that means overriding areas of Jewish law. So numerous authorities write, what I brought you in, source number three, I brought it for you from Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, the Mishnah Brura, talking about somebody who needs medical intervention on Shabbos to save his life, and he says, well, I don't want to break Shabbos. The answer is, too bad. Kofin oso, they compel him, there's that coercion. Umedabrim alibo, and we speak to his heart, we try to convince him, shu chasidus shel shtus, that for him to refrain from medical treatment in order to avoid violating Shabbos is what we call foolish piety. That's inappropriate. Similarly, in source number four from the Shulchan, 40, excuse me, source number 40 from the Shulchan Aruch, from the Code of Jewish Law, if somebody is ill on Yom Kippur and says he does not want to eat, and the doctor says you need to eat, even if the patient denies needing it, we listen to the doctor. The patient has to eat. And there are many examples of this. There's another law which talks about a person who takes a vow saying that he will not accept medical care. And the Shach, Rabbi Shabbosei HaKohen, writing on the Shulchan Aruch, says, too bad, you already are subject to a vow you took at Sinai to protect your life. So you can't take a vow that you're not going to receive medical care. That's not legitimate. There are numerous sources that we could bring in order to support this. So on life and death matters, you're not entitled to say, I don't want to pursue medical care. Now, I should be very careful as I say that, because, of course, we're living in a society with medical assistance in dying. And even less dramatically, there are issues in end-of-life care where a person is entitled, as a matter of Jewish law, to refrain from certain treatments. So I shouldn't make a blanket statement like you always have to intervene. That's not true. However, outside of an end-of-life acute type of a situation, as a general principle, we are required to intervene to save our lives. What about if it's not a life and death matter? What if it's just about getting treated for something or choosing to leave it alone and it's not going to become fatal? It's not an infection. It's not a tumor. It's something that's just a chronic issue. So are we still obligated to pursue treatment for it? So we are taught that God wants us to look after our physical well-being and to avoid pain. I can give numerous examples of this, and I will. I'll give you four right now, although each of them is really flawed. One example of it, the Talmud talks about the case of the Nazir. A Nazir is somebody who takes a vow, and among the elements of the vow is that he's not going to drink wine, or she is not going to drink wine. At the end of the period of being a Nazir, the Nazir has to bring karbanot, has to bring sacrifices, and one of those sacrifices is what's called a chatat, a sin offering. Why? What sin has the Nazir committed by becoming a Nazir? So the truth is, on a technical level, the answer is, it's not that they committed a sin. They have to bring a certain sacrifice in order to end the obligations of being a Nazir. And it happens to look like what we usually call a sin offering, but they didn't sin. However, the Talmud has an explanation for this sin offering, saying that the Nazir has to bring this offering because he pained himself by not drinking wine. He has caused himself pain. So that expresses a value that you're not supposed to cause yourself pain. However, you could make the argument that that's a case where somebody proactively causes pain. That's not a case in which one simply allows pain to continue because they feel like it's better than pursuing treatment. We also have a passage in the Talmud which teaches that one is not allowed to wound oneself, even where the wound will not be fatal. So you could argue that demonstrates that, again, we are responsible to pursue medical care, conventional medical care, in a case of pain. However, once again, that's a case in which one actively harms oneself, not doing that in this situation. Another example of that passage in the Jerusalem Talmud at the end of the tractate called Kiddushin talks about the value of sampling every new fruit that is available in order to be able to exalt God, thanking God for having produced all of this wonderful bounty for us. Is that really proof, though? The fact that you're supposed to enjoy the world? That's about enjoying the world. That's not about avoiding harm. Maimonides writes at one point in his work of law that a person has to be healthy in order to be able to serve God. Okay, but that's not really a legal statement. That's more a statement of a value. So you could make the argument that if you're dealing with a life and death matter, you have to pursue conventional medical care. How, again, assuming it's not that dramatic end of life situation case. However, in the event that it's not a life and death matter, it's a lesser thing, then maybe you don't have an obligation to pursue conventional medical care. But when you do have a duty to pursue conventional medical care, when that does come up, then we are taught that that means you have to go to the experts and you have to get the treatments that are the product of our medical knowledge and expertise. I brought you in source 41 and source 42 sources that support this. Source 41 relates to a well-known problem. Ramban Nachmanides, in his commentary on the Torah in the 13th century, talks about how when Jews are at the height of piety, they won't need doctors. You appeal to God, and God will take care of healing people and protecting people. So that leads some people to think that pursuing medical care is somehow a violation of God's will. However, Nachmanides writes elsewhere in his works of Jewish law, Toras HaAdam, his commentary to the Talmud as well, that we are meant to pursue medical care. We are not living in the age of prophets and prophecy and open miracles. And Rabbi Eliezer Waldenberg, in source number 41, writing towards the end of the 20th century, said, since almost the great majority of people, do not merit healing via miracles from heaven, and the Torah itself says not to depend upon miracles, this permission to pursue healing applies to patients as well. It's permission to doctors to practice. It is permission for patients to pursue healing. Further, it is a mitzvah and an obligation since his life depends upon it. We do have to seek medical care. Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, in his Minchas Yitzchak, was asked a very interesting question. There was a woman who wanted to have children. And the doctor, a woman was, I believe, had cancer. And the chemotherapy they wanted to give her would render her unable to have children. And she desperately wanted to have children. And the question is, does she have to listen to the doctor and take this medicine, knowing she will not be able to have children, which is certainly something that's highly valued within Judaism? And Rabbi Yitzchak Weiss, I brought you a one-line excerpt in source number 42, says, Mama hani ritzona bazem dina hachi. He says, if this is the law, this is the law. What does the patient's desire have to do with it? It's beautiful that she wants to be able to have children, but not at the expense of her life. So applying this to the case in vignette number 3, where there are stories about somebody having taken a combination of various items which are not currently recognized as conventional medicine, and not taking conventional medicine, it seems fairly clear that we follow the standard we have defined of effective medical care, that which is tested and certified by experts as the standard of care, and therefore one would not be entitled, certainly in a life-threatening case, one would not be entitled to choose alternative medicine over conventional. Complementary, if it's not going to create harm, if it's not involving prohibitions, that's a different story. But to choose alternative medicine over the conventional? Nah, I don't see a basis for it. Finally, case number 4. Susan contracts hepatitis C, which leads to severe hepatic fibrosis. A scattered network of medical practitioners claims to have succeeded in treating this condition with extremely small doses of arsenic trioxide, a toxic compound which is used in certain cancer treatments. Government health officials warn that the treatment has not been rigorously tested for safety or efficacy and is extremely hazardous. Susan has a cousin who recommends the treatment and can provide it for her. Susan's conventional doctors are not holding out much hope for reversing the fibrosis via conventional medicine. Are there circumstances in which halacha would permit Susan to try this treatment? So the case goes a little bit back and forth. Let me make sure that we're clear. She has what seems to be a fatal disease, the severe hepatic fibrosis. There are those who claim to have had success with arsenic trioxide, which is a toxic compound. Government health officials warn this has not been tested, not for safety, not for efficacy, and it's extremely hazardous. Susan has a way to get it. On the other hand, this alternative approach, you know, that's being sold to her, so to speak, at least holds out something. The conventional doctors say we don't really have options for her. So what would you say here, where the option that's in front of her from the alternative medicine side could be a danger to her short-term survival? On the other hand, we're not holding out hope for long-term survival. So what would be the rule here? So here, let's ask the question this way. What if instead of an untested alternative treatment, we were talking about a conventional option, something that had been tested conventionally and found to be dangerous but potentially beneficial? Let's say we were talking about corticosteroids, where there's a possibility that they could help, but they're also dangerous to give, and over the long term, certainly so. What would we say there? Why do we need to go to arsenic trioxide? You have this within conventional medicine as well. So Rabbi Yaakov Reicher in 17th century Prague dealt with this question. He dealt with the question of a potentially harmful treatment, something that could abbreviate one's short-term survival, taken in order to try to extend long-term survival. So look at Rabbi Reicher in my excerpt here in source number 43. He says, in this case, since he will certainly die without the treatment, meaning if you leave things alone, the patient is not going to make it, we leave the certainty and take the possibility he might be healed. I'm willing to take that risk. Still, the doctor should not simply proceed with this. He must be very patient, checking with local expert doctors and deciding based on the majority of views, meaning a recognizable majority, which is double. He wants a 2/3 majority among the experts consulted. For there is concern regarding frivolous people, because not everybody is necessarily as careful in these decisions. Therefore, he should follow the majority of medical opinions and the agreement of the leading local authority. So Rabbi Yaakov Reicher's position is that if it is supported by medical experts, then you can go with a tactic which will endanger long-term, which will endanger short-term survival in an attempt to try to get long-term survival. That's point number one, is that there is a possibility of making this trade-off. However, what if the experts you consult, and this came up in the question and answer after the first part, what if the experts you consult think that this medicine really is going to harm? Not like, well, this could be a trade-off, you know, you could be abbreviating, but like, no, we actually think that this is going to be a fatal treatment. Now what do you do? So Rabbi David Ibn Abi Zimra in the Radbaz in 16th century Egypt says, if the patient says, I need this medicine, and the doctor says the medicine would harm him, we listen to the doctor. because of the danger to the patient, and even during the week. Not only his context is Shabbos, can you take it on Shabbos? Just forget Shabbos. You can't take this at all. If the doctor says it's harmful, you don't take it. And Rabbi Avram Gambiner in the Magen Avram in source number 45 rules likewise. So if the doctor actually says this is going to kill the patient, then that's not taking a risk. That's simply unacceptable. It's only where there is some reason to think that it could work. That's where you have this conversation, and that's where it becomes relevant.